Hello, interwebs, and welcome to another episode of Paul Owens and Dr. Witz's Colloquium on Games of Strategy, Episode 6 by Dixit, Skeeth, and Riley. I'm Austin Smokewitz, one half of Dr. Witz.
I'm Aaron Hanswitz, the other half of Dr. Witz.
I'm Paul Owen.
And Dr. Witz is proud to say that our card game, You Fool, produced by Button Shy Games, is now live at Button Shy Games. You can order it today.
We're all excited.
So today we are going to be talking about Chapter 6, Combining Sequential and Simultaneous Moves.
Right. As we got into these games of strategy, we started off with sequential games, right? I talked about how somebody makes a decision and then that decision branches off to an opportunity for someone else to make a decision and so on. And that sequence of decisions constructed a tree with payoffs at the end. And then we talked about simultaneous move games where I make a decision that you don't know about, you make a decision I don't know about. We compare our respective choices on a matrix, and this resulting cell in the matrix determines what the payoff is of our game. And those were two pure cases, a sequential move game like chess, a simultaneous move game like rock, paper, scissors. So this chapter is our first opportunity to look at games that actually combine both structures in a single game. And it has some interesting ramifications when you look at that and how you can start to shift back and forth between sequential and simultaneous or integrate the two of them together in the same game. So, for example, there's an investment scenario where you have two companies investing in or choosing whether or not to invest in, say, a fiber optic network and providing a fiber optic network service. And then comes the decision of whether to price it low or price it high. And that becomes basically a sequence of simultaneous games where if it's Dr. Witz Fiber Network Company and Paul Owen Fiber Network Company, and we each decide, am I going to invest or not? If neither of us decides to invest, neither of us makes any money, neither of us loses any money. If one of us invests, the other one doesn't, then the one who invested has full reign of the entire of the market and can choose a high price. So that's their two-step process. That's that sequence of a simultaneous decision followed by a sequential decision. The interesting thing comes when we both decide to invest. Now we're faced with another simultaneous move game. Do I price high? Do I price low? If I price high and you price low, I get nothing. So the Nash equilibrium of that game is going to be we're both going to price low and we're both going to lose money. Right. And if that's the expected outcome of both investing, and you do the rollback analysis from that sequence of simultaneous move games, you end up not investing because you're only going to lose money if your competitor invests, and you can't count on your competitor not investing.
Which is a way to explain why wireless networks within the United States are still so. they don't invest a lot into them. That's for sure.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Or at least they didn't at this time. But Aaron, I understand that going back to the first edition, you have something similar, but something different.
So economists are having fun here. We're talking about entry games. In my book, it was R&D instead of telecom. And you know, if I want to talk more deal about telecom, that's a separate conversation. This is actually my specialty in economics. So There's a lot of reasons why there's problems with the telecom stuff and
So our book is just simplifies the telecom problem just a wee too much.
Right. Well, it could be one of many problems.
A subset of problems.
Subset of problems, yes. Yes. Subsets will be one of our favorite words tonight.
We can talk about how changing that investment game into a sequential game, or the first decision into a sequential game, can change the outcome. So if, say, Dr. Witz Internet company decides to invest first and Paul Owen waits to see what Dr. Witz does, then I see, you guys are investing. If I compete with you, I'm going to lose money. I may as well stay out. But you're in and you've decided to invest and now you've got the whole market yourself and you make a ton of money. All I can do if I invest is cause us both to lose money.
Let's bring this right to the board gaming world because the example he described is the most realistic example we've really had in this book of describing a lot of games we play. Because most games we play are not just purely one or the other. I mean, there are examples.
Right.
Chess is purely a sequential game. Okay, maybe you can get me there. You can argue there's a lot of sequential games. But a lot of simultaneous games, they're not purely one-off simultaneous game. When I play the Resistance, we play a simultaneous game, then there's a pause, and then we play another simultaneous game in the set of sequential order. But no, I mean, we have lots of games where you make a simultaneous move, you see the results, and then you adjust what you're doing. I mean, this is diplomacy. We make a simultaneous move of what everyone's doing in the game. We see what happens, and based on what happens, that changes our next set of moves. And if we're really good, you know, potentially, depending on the payoff matrix, there might be a set of optimal strategies. There might be. Now, the example in the book, which was the introductory example, they showed you that there was a specific set of Nash equilibriums. But as we know from our discussions, games don't always have a pure strategy Nash equilibrium result.
Right. Or they may be too complex to calculate what that Nash equilibrium is.
But now we're starting to be in the more comfortable world of the games we actually deal with and starting to model them. Because now that we are doing these multi-step models, we aren't just thinking about the one instance and the results of that one instance. If we're being good designers, we're thinking about each step, how that step is going to influence the next step. And if someone's really skilled, the skilled players are already making those plans in the earlier stages of the game.
Right.
Let's start thinking about the resistance. Let's start thinking about diplomacy. Let's start thinking about these simultaneous games they step.
Simultaneous. Yes, yes.
A pause, and then people have to make their next decision, and they're going to make it based on what just happened.
Resistance is a very interesting example. It's simple enough to kind of get our hands around, but it's got some great dynamics going on in anticipation of what your opponents might do and what options are available in the next move based on what you do in this move. For example, a common, I'm going to say, strategy or rule of thumb or whatever for a first move is if you are a spy and you have been selected to be on the first team, you never vote to sabotage the first mission. I don't know whether that's 100% rule. In fact, I'd be curious to hear if any of our listeners have counterexamples to that thinking. But it's intended to throw suspicion off the two people who are on the first team. So then, of course, you get nothing except that you get a free mission for the resistance.
So you're describing the problem we brought up earlier is that the strategy is so preordained that first stage of the game is useless in a weird way, uninteresting.
Right. Unless you are of a school of thought that says
playing the resistance.
That's how they solved that issue in Secret Hitler. Okay, so what they do differently is when it comes to whether or not the equivalency of a mission succeeding or not in Secret Hitler is you have a deck that is shuffled and dealt out, and the characters have to pick the card if they succeed or not. And the thing is that because it's a deck of cards, of one deck of cards, as opposed to each individual person involved making the decision, it is possible for the deck to just not go your way and you don't have an option to succeed. Rarer at the beginning, but it is possible. And it is possible to hide the fact that you don't have the option to succeed. But just like in the resistance, if things fail, you know, automatically, people don't go to, oh, well, I guess the deck wasn't in your favor. They go straight to, well, somebody is obviously a traitor on that team.
Then go to the same question, what is the long-term strategy? Because this is a hard problem to solve in a deduction game like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it always a dominant strategy to hide? And if it is, how do you break that?
Right. And I'm not convinced that it is. I mean, let's go ahead and game out the first two turns. If it's a five-player game, if I'm a spy, I'm on the first team, and I vote to sabotage the first play. So the spies have a point, basically. The next two-player team has to consist of two out of the remaining three players. If my fellow spy is among those other three players, there's a two-thirds chance that he's going to be on the second team.
Right. So in a five-player game, you have three resistance members and two spies.
I sabotage the first mission, and if my teammate is on the new team and sabotages the second mission, now they have 50-50 knowledge whether I'm a spy or the other person who's on the first team, only a 33% knowledge of knowing. No, again, 50-50 on who's on the second team. They only know one safe player. That one safe player is going to be on every team from then on, but they basically have to guess right on really a 25% chance on the three-man teams, a 50% chance on the remaining two-man team in the remaining three rounds. So I sort of feel like it's not necessarily an automatic strategy. It'd be interesting. It'd actually be interesting to kind of map that all out.
Right, because they alternate between two-person team, a three-person team, a two-person team, and then two three-person teams in a row.
Right.
And of course, with the idea being that by the time you get to the end of the game, the three resistance members should know who each other are, or you are most likely going to fail, lose the game.
So anyway, where does that leave us with
looking at
combinations of sequential and simultaneous move games?
Yeah, let's loop this back then.
Right.
So second edition and third edition books loops back to the Battle of the Sexes game that we love talking about.
Oh, yes. Right. Actually, my book didn't go into the Battle of the Sexes.
Really?
Although I thought of it as I was taking my notes.
because it talks about the fact about how in a sequential game, they start to talk about first mover advantage.
Right, right.
Yeah. And of course, the Battle of the Sexes, as always, is the quintessential best example of how and why you want to be the first player in right. some games.
Right. Just like the investment game, if you can choose to invest before I have the opportunity to choose, and I see that you've chosen to invest, I'm motivated not to invest. So there's definitely a first mover advantage in that game.
And then, of course, they counter that with second mover advantages. Hey, so instead of going first, you get to go second, and you get to then react to what the other player is doing.
The interesting thing that, as I was mapping this all out in my head, I came up with an interesting conclusion. If I have a basic 2x2 simultaneous game with a dominant strategy equilibrium, a single equilibrium, if I convert that into a sequential game, that's still going to be the payoff of the game. It doesn't matter what order we go in. The result is going to be the same. So, for example, in a prisoner's dilemma, even if Austin and I are prisoners, you know, we're going to rat each other out if it's a simultaneous decision. If I get first decision before Austin decides, I know that if I clam up, he's going to rat me out. I'm going to do the time and he's going to get off scot-free. So I'm not going to clam up. I'm going to rat him out. Then he's going to see that I ratted him out and he's going to rat me out. So the result is the same because it's a strong equilibrium. Second case, what if there are two equilibria? Right. And the example for that might be chicken, where either you swerve and I don't, and I win the game, or I swerve and you don't, and you win the game. So when it's simultaneous, there's kind of no telling what's going to happen because there are two equilibria. But if one of us makes a credible signal, one person gets to decide first, I'm not going to swerve. Okay, Austin, what are you going to do? Clearly, you're going to swerve. So there's a first mover advantage in that game. So my conclusion is a simultaneous move game with two equilibria, if you convert it into a sequential move game, it has a first player advantage. Now, if you have a game with no stable equilibrium, you're going to get a second mover advantage. And it's like the Navratilova-Evert competition, where you're either doing a down-the-line shot or a crossing shot. There's no equilibrium on that. But if Navratilova gets to react to Evert, Evert commits to a down-the-line shot, and then Navratilova can react, then the second mover has the advantage based on the first mover's decision. So if there's one equilibrium, it doesn't matter. If there's two equilibria, then there's a first mover advantage. If there's no equilibrium, then there's a second player advantage, second mover advantage.
So I don't think it's whether or not if there's one equilibria. With the prisoner's dilemma, it was the fact that there was dominant strategies. That no matter I was always better off if I made that one particular decision.
So it's a more specific case of dominant strategies rather than just any case with a single equilibrium?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'll buy that.
I mean, the great thing is fits into the definition of dominant strategy. If you were explained this to someone else, you'd say, well, it's a dominant strategy because there is no better strategy. There's nothing right. I can do my strategy. We have to think carefully. I mean, the challenge, of course, is when you start adding multiple players, things can get a little more crazy. But at least in yes. a two-player game, if one player has a dominant strategy, then that will push you to a single equilibrium. There can be exceptions. Someone can have a dominant strategy and someone's indifferent between different equilibriums, in which case you'd have more than one. But
so the monetary fiscal policy game is interesting from a standpoint of it has a dominant strategy for the Congress. But if you construct it as a sequential move game with the Congress moving first, you end up with a different result. By way of background, the whole premise is Congress controls the budget, either a balanced budget or a deficit budget. The Fed controls the interest rates, low or high. Congress's preference is for low interest rates, first of all, but they don't control the interest rates. They do control the budget, rather. And they also like budget deficits because their constituents like more programs. But first thing is they like low interest rates because that's good for business, it's good for loans and that kind of stuff. Conversely, the Fed prefers a balanced budget. It's better for the economy. And then secondarily prefers low interest rates because they're good for the economy. You're the economist. You know better than I do. But the point is, each one is kind of primarily interested in what the other one is doing, Congress preferring low interest rates and the Fed preferring a balanced budget. However, the deficit budget is a dominant strategy for the Congress. In a simultaneous move game, the Congress will default to a budget deficit because it's better in both cases, low or high interest rates, better for the Congress. And therefore, knowing that, the Fed is going to have to go with a high interest rate to avoid the inflationary results of a deficit budget. And so neither of them really gets completely what they want out of that. If you make that a sequential game, if Congress commits to a budget first, Congress says, okay, I'm looking at what the Fed is going to do after I make my decision. If I choose a balanced budget, the Fed is going to see, oh, there's no inflationary pressure. I can do low interest rates. And what I really want is low interest rates. So the Congress says, if I pass a balanced budget, the Fed can approve a low interest rate, and that's much better for my constituents, and I much prefer that result. And so does the Fed. So by making it a sequential game, with Congress going first, even though Congress has a dominant strategy, they will choose the other strategy and get a better payoff than they would have if it had been a simultaneous game. That, I think, was the most interesting thing that I got out of the whole book, that by converting that simultaneous move game with a clear equilibrium into a sequential game, the payoff was higher for both parties, and the result was not the same as the equilibrium. I thought that was very interesting. It's hard to sort of verbalize. It's a lot easier to see in graphs and pictures.
I've had to work backwards the payoffs because it wasn't in my book, but I can see how that could occur. So you're right. Having one dominant strategy is not sufficient to guarantee a sub-game perfect equilibrium in a sequential game would be a simultaneous game. It takes two. Both players have to have a dominant strategy for that to work out.
Now, Aaron, you just brought up a big phrase here, something that is bolded in our books as a key term. I think you're going to have to explain what that term is. You just said sub-game perfect equilibrium.
So when you think of the game, there are lots of different steps to solving it. And if you could think of those steps as being little different nodes, they can each be their own game within themselves. Sub-game perfect is, let's figure out what's going to happen if in every step of the process, people always make the decision that will be in their best payout, their best interest. And if you do that, then you can reach potentially a select set of choices that will occur.
Right. So this is what we've been doing since chapter two. So how is this different?
Well, the reason we're bringing it up is that there could be things that happen within a game that can throw you out of the sub-game perfect equilibrium. Whether you fall for a bluff, whether you think something may be credible or non-credible, it can lead to a decision which puts you on a completely different path. And once you do that, you're no longer sub-game perfect, which doesn't mean you don't have choices to make the best of your situation. The player's assumption that the other players are playing this way, and no longer you have the same faith that you can just game out the entire outcome.
So it's the what happens when you're gaming with a fool question.
Actually, it doesn't have to be a fool. You know, it could be someone who wants you to think they are the fool so that they can get a better outcome for themselves. But at least in my book, it wasn't very interested in diving into that question yet. It saw that as a future topic when it got the focus more on bluffing and credible commitments. You know, it did mention that, you know, if you could bluff someone to do something, then, you know, this starts becoming a real issue. But there are conditions that have to be met for that to be successful. And, you know, like I said, they want to push that off for a later discussion. My book was much more interested in the idea that we're talking about sequential games, talking about simultaneous games, and sticking with our world of still pure strategy equilibriums, you can change the outcome of the games by changing the situation you're in from one type of game to the other. Paul was already bringing that up with the Fed and the Congress. But, you know, you could rethink that situation in the competitive environment. In my book, there's this big focus on an election. It was initially a sequential game. In the sequential game, the incumbent got to decide whether they're going to advertise or not advertise during the election cycle. And a potential challenger then got to decide whether or not they're going to enter or not enter into that election. In the sequential game version, the incumbent always had to run ads, and the entrant would always stay out of the race.
Right. Yep. Hmm. A little bit like the fiber optic network problem, where if you choose to invest first, I'm not inclined to invest.
Yes. But if the other player, the challenger, could somehow find a way to change this from a sequential game to a simultaneous game, then there's a whole new equilibrium. Because when that happened, the gray player had a dominant strategy to never run ads. So the incumbent had a dominant strategy to never run ads. And the green player, which is the person entering the market to run for the office, mm-hmm. would then have a strategy to enter the race. And that was a higher payoff for them than the sequential game. And so because the different game types create different winners or losers, it creates a meta game of what type of game we're playing. And it creates a challenge for board game designers, because good players are going to see this in a design, and they're going to try to game the system to put themselves in the game that will make them win or have a better chance of winning. And you can go either direction, whether you're going from a sequential game to a simultaneous game or a simultaneous game to a sequential game. I mean, there's another example in this book about entrance for retail outlets, where there was a rural location and an urban location. And with the urban location, it was best for all companies if there's only two people there and not three, so it's a three-player game. And the rural location, it was great if three people showed up to the rural location, but two of the people would be better if they were at their urban location. And there was another minor point payout where one of those three giants, even if all three of them went to the urban location, the other two would do well and they wouldn't. And in the sequential game, there was one equilibrium. That equilibrium was really good for two of the players and not the best for the third player. But if that game could be forced to be a simultaneous game, then that changed how the game was going to play. And now this third player had a shot of a better outcome. And that outcome, you know, when you do this, there might be explicitly a set of equilibrium. So when we talked about the entry game for voting and the person who was going to run ads or not run ads and the person who was going to enter or not enter the election, there were one Nash equilibrium based on if it was a simultaneous game or a sequential game. Or you could have outcomes where there might be no equilibriums, there might be multiple equilibriums, but as long as those situations are still a better situation for players in a zero-sum game, then the equilibrium, if it doesn't change, they have an incentive to metagame and to manipulate the game, which means players try to find ways when they play your games to change your game, even if that was not what you intended to happen, because it fits the interests they need to achieve. I mean, I think we can think of a lot of games where players try to make actions that change the game to their advantage, you know, try to change it from being a sequential game or simultaneous game. I think of the player who puts down their card and says, I'm doing this already. You know, that, right. That's one way of trying to change a simultaneous game to a sequential game.
Right.
Or I can see players where it's supposed to be a sequential game to say, look, let's just all reveal at the same time. Again, they're doing the same thing. They're changing the game. And when they do that, they are changing potentially what is the equilibrium. And if they're doing it well, they're doing it to their advantage.
As designers, that's the thing we have to be aware of as we're ratcheting down our rule sets to try to find where these points in our game could potentially be open for rules lawyers and players who are trying to take advantage of our systems.
I agree we have to worry about that. I wouldn't be as technical as you say it.
Because it's also possible that things are intentionally left vague to allow for said play.
That's true. But some of it is just going to be what's the culture that your gamers play.
Does this lend credence to the idea of creating more asymmetrical games so that you have the potential for players trying to manipulate the game in specific ways to bring it to their advantage?
Well, yes, but that means the skilled players will start asking, well, why do you want to be sequential? Why do you want to be simultaneous? And you know, if you do sequential, I mean, sequential has the extra complication of the first and second mover advantage. I mean, just think of kicking penalty goals in soccer. Let's say we made it a sequential game. Do you want the first mover or the second mover? Do you want me to go, if you're to go in the kicker, do you want me the first mover or the second mover? Sequential game. Penalty shootout.
Right. So going back to my hypothesis, since there's two equilibria, no, there's no equilibrium, then you prefer to be the second mover. You prefer to react to what your opponent does and then do the opposite if you're the kicker, or do the same if you're the goalie.
Yeah, but you should, once it's a sequential game, there are equilibriums. It just happens.
Once it's a sequential game, right.
The first.
As a simultaneous game, it has no equilibrium.
Yes, and that's the magic of the strategy. You know, once you're playing that game, you're trying to create a situation that's to your advantage. If you know you're going to be the second mover in the sequential game, you're trying to make this into a sequential game. And if you know you're going to be the first mover in the sequential game, you're doing your darndest to make it into a simultaneous game.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
The biggest takeaway from this chapter is this ability to transform how your game worked just by what seems to some people maybe innocent little decisions.
You mean in terms of what order do players make their moves, or what do you do simultaneously instead of sequentially? Even if all the actions are the same, even if all the decision options are the same.
Who gets to go first, who gets to go second, and what information you have at the time of making your move
right
makes a big difference.
Does someone go first.
Do I play my card face up and my opponent gets to make a decision based on what I played? Or do I play my card face down and my opponent has to decide what to play before he sees what I play? In other words, so that it's a simultaneous move in that case.
Exactly. You know, you can see how people, unless you're really strong in your rule set, if you're really strong, you know there's going to be a player that says, look, let's tell you guys right now, I don't want to mess around. Here's what I'm doing. I put the card up. And we might think initially, well, that's pretty innocent. But if we really think about it, that's not pretty, that's pretty manipulative. They have just messed with the rule set to give them the advantage in the game. And they are successful because they went first. And unless people decide they care about something other than just winning, which they might, I'll bring that up in a moment, they're stuck. Now, might's important here because metagaming changes things. And part of metagaming is you're playing something more than once.
Right.
Do we consider playing a game for person a second time, the extension of this game theory, in which case we now have rational reasons to respond to that person who is the game, to punish them in an attempt to influence their behavior in the next game.
Another example kind of came to mind. If I think of pool as strictly a game of skill, let's suppose I'm playing a series of games of pool with you. The only decision I'm making is how much money to bet on the next game. If we're treating it strictly a game of skill, we're each going to play as well as we can. I'm assuming we're each going to play as well as we can. And I'm going to base the amount of money I bet on how confident I am in beating you in the next game. I might base that decision on how well I did in the previous game. But now that might motivate you not to play your best game first. In other words, to try to hustle me and make me think that you're not such a great player and then jack up the bet and beat me in the second or third game.
Which again starts bringing us to the later discussion of what is a credible commitment. You've seen how this is this important topic that's going to come and smack us all in the face. But you're also starting to see this has important implications and implications that we purposely put ourselves in situations to experience. Paul, you've been to the World Board Gaming Championship. You have dealt with different types of tournament plays.
Right.
You have, in essence, a game, a pause, another game.
Right.
Our game, where we could talk about NBA games. My team has already secured a position in the playoffs. How do I play the game I'm playing right now, if I'm thinking about the championship?
Right.
Or talking about a very famous paper in economics about sumo wrestlers. Are you guys familiar with this?
No.
I believe I've heard of some interesting shenanigans going on in the sumo world, yes.
Shenanigans.
There is shenanigans.
I always thought it was the most honorable of sports.
So what they found is that, let's say, Paul, you're facing Austin. And, Paul, you've already secured your position to make it to the next round. But Austin has it. He needs to win one more match.
All right.
I'm about to be eliminated. If you beat me, I'm going to be out.
But regardless,
I'm going to fall below the line. That's right. No matter what happens, you're in. But
and does my seed change depending on whether I win or lose?
I don't know enough to tell you that.
Okay.
I think it's just a ranking issue. Like you're in a division or you're out of a division.
Oh, I see.
Right?
I see.
So I'm about to get, if I lose one more match, I'm going to be kicked out of this division. But you are very secure.
I'm in. Okay. Gotcha.
Who wins?
I win. It's close. It's close. But I win. Thank you.
So let me think about that. What's my motivation? I guess I'm most concerned about not injuring myself for the next round. Is that true? Is that my primary concern? I know, because I think about this in terms of the NFL, they tend not to play their starters if they've secured a playoff berth and home field advantage because they don't want to injure them. Or is there another consideration in sumo wrestling I'm not taking into account?
So I'm pulling up the article right now.
Yeah. The reason why I say shenanigans is that I believe there was another angle to this story as well, because they found that this practice was happening too frequently. And so
the underdog would win by a slight margin disproportionately often.
Right. And that, you know, in some cases, if you just looked at it from a purely mathematical way, you could even say that there might be some honor in it, in this idea of, not just going to crush somebody. However,
what the paper suggests is that if I help you get into the next round now, when you're on the bubble in the future and you're facing me, I will reciprocate the favor.
Ah, interesting. So I'm basically forming an alliance for the next round, after a fashion.
Future point, yes.
Yes, a little bit of unsportsman collusion going on.
Ah, gotcha.
And then, of course, I believe there was a money angle to this as well, because people do bet on these games.
I never like
I
betting
think
on
that's
human athletes. Horses, I'll bet on, never people.
right, because the horses don't have a person riding them trying to tell them how to do things, right? Because the horses just ignore that jockey on their back. Forget you, I'm running faster now.
I think, Paul, you're down the Greyhound.
Right. Yeah, you're down to the Greyhounds now.
Down to the Greyhounds, right? No jockeys on Greyhounds, right?
Little ponies, run little ponies.
So I think we should summarize. We've identified how the construct of a game can affect its outcome, and how we would analyze games that are essentially hybrids of simultaneous and sequential games, and how and what happens when you change a simultaneous into a sequential or vice versa.
So I do have to ask, did any board games come to mind that were was able to pull off this kind of hybrid concept as you were thinking it through? Or is this, or do you consider this to be untread territory for board game designers?
You know, have you ever played Spartacus?
Spartacus.
Spartacus is a game. Each of us is a Dominus, I think it's called, a high player in Rome, of course. And the idea is to get the most influence. And the interesting thing about the game is that negotiations are pretty fast and loose. Money can change hands at any time for any reason,
Good.
and commitments can be honored or not. I do think everything has to happen sequentially. In other words, I can't hold money out to you and say, if you play that card, I'll give you this money. But if you don't play the card, I get the money back. It's I
Okay.
promise you the money and you play the card, and
And
then I honor
then,
my promise or not. Or
or
I give you the
not.
money, you promise to play the card, and you play the card or not. There's a lot of opportunity there to change results depending on what sequence you agree on, including you're allowed to show people cards. You know, I'm going to play this card right here, and if you pay me $5, I'll play it on him instead, you know, or something like that. So Spartacus is the best example I can think of where you can control the outcome of a decision tree by changing the sequence of events.
But you're changing that though by changing the expected reward payout. What you're talking about is as you go along, you are physically like crossing out and rewriting in the payment,
That's
the
that's
strategic
true.
box of saying like, no, yes, now I will pay you five. No, I'll pay you six to do this differently,
I guess
which
that's
is
I guess
interesting, which is very interesting. Aaron, do any games come to mind when we talk about the switching between simultaneous and
sequential.
sequential in the game itself. I know that you brought up examples of how people would try to game a system to make it one way or the other, but do any games come to your mind that have that as a natural part of the game? Or is this more untread territory for game designers?
I don't know. It sounds like
That's fair.
a design opportunity.
Yeah.
Yes. So we didn't get into the three-player game case, I don't think. Maybe we discussed it briefly. But yeah, so I think like I said, I found it very interesting how you can change the outcome by changing a simultaneous game to sequential. Also interesting how you can analyze a game as a series of simultaneous games or changing order of play. So yeah, and I appreciate the you know Aaron's effort to tie this into where how does this actually affect real game design? What can we do in terms of the way we construct our games to I guess protect against players who manipulate the construct of the game? And what circumstances might we create first mover advantage or second mover advantage? And maybe if we assuming that we want to avoid those, what kind of tools do we have at our disposal to avoid those?
So, definitely for anybody out there listening, look into this and see if you if any ideas come to mind as you design your next game.
So I can think of a really good example of a game that is a sequence of simultaneous move games. And that's one where each player has a card and chooses where you try to manipulate order and manipulate the what your opponents are doing. And then you're doing that as a sequence of essentially smaller games. And that is a game in which there's only one loser and everybody else wins. And that would be You Fool by Dr. Witz.
You don't say.
A clever little micro game, a great little study in game design and up at Buttonshy Games.
Buttonshygames.com. And what's really interesting is that as someone, as I was playing this yesterday, somebody was like, hey, this is there's a little bit of a three-door Monty going on here. And I go, yes, except, and in a way, just like three-door Monty, you have one player who's sitting there going, oh, but behind this card is is this. And you have to
there's a goat over here.
It's there's something with four legs over here. And you go, well, now, I wonder what that could be. So great. Buttonshygames.com. You Fool. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of our colloquium on Games of Strategy by Dixit, Skeeth, and Riley. The next chapter is my chapter 7 is Simultaneous Move Games with Mixed Strategies 1, Zero Sum Games. And I have to say, this is a beast of a chapter. This is like a good 50 some pages in my book.
My chapter 7 is also fairly lengthy. It looks like it's 50 pages. And the title is slightly different. Simultaneous Move Games with Mixed Strategies 1, 2x2 Games.
2x2 Games.
And it includes a subsection on zero-sum games and then also goes into non-zero-sum games.
Okay.
Now, the actual chapter itself looks like it's 25 pages, and then there's a lengthy appendix apparently on probability algebras.
Okay. Okay, so that might be what that's all about.
Yeah.
I think we're finally catching up to Aaron in his book because, you know, they break it, they slow it down for us later on. But I think we're finally catching up to Aaron. So I'm sure he will have a lot more to say as we move forward. So
my name is Paul Owen, best known on the internet for Dice Tower News. You can follow me on Twitter at Paul Owen Games. Although I haven't written much lately, I do have a blog, paulowengames.blogspot.com. My intention, my next several posts will essentially be summaries of the last several chapters we've been discussing in Games of Strategy. So we'll actually have some kind of a written summary of these discussions we've been doing over the last several episodes. And I can be reached on BoardGameGeek. My user ID there is PDOwen3.
And of course, you can follow Aaron and I at DRWitz. So you can find us online at dr.witz.com. That's dr.witz.com. Thank you everybody for listening, and I want to say see you in the next one, but that's also, I think that's taken on the interwebs, and I'm just going to stop the broadcast.